So I was at a men's breakfast earlier this summer, and I was chatting with Dave Butler. He's away at a trials thing this weekend. And I was talking to him because he used to be a maintenance foreman at the mines in Sudbury, and he's an expert welder and has a workshop and all this stuff. And I said, what do you think I should do with this? And he said, well, let me come have a look at it. So he came over. He's like, you know what we could, oh, you know, and you just see the wheels start to turn in his head. We could do this. And we could cut the frame off there, and we could take this. And you don't want that floor. So you take the floor off, and you do that, and then we'll do this, and we'll take, and then, and he's getting all excited on me, right? And then he's like, and I've got these stainless steel, aluminum fenders, and you can stand on them. They're good heavy-duty ones. They're just sitting around. We can use them. We'll put them. So I take the walls off the trailer. I rip the floor off the trailer. I get my trailer license plate and take it up to Dave Butler's house, and it's just a frame with nothing on it by this point. And then after 2 days, I've only spent two evenings, actually, so just a couple hours working with him, we have taken the extra frame off. We've ground it down. We've taken the back part off. And he said, we'll cut the back off. Sorry, I'm excited about this. I hope you don't mind. He said, we'll cut it back. We'll cut the back off right there, so all the rotten parts of the frame will be gone. And I said, well, won't that mean that the axle will be in the wrong place? Oh, yeah, we'll just move that. So we took the axle off it and the wheels off it, and we have it flipped upside down, and we're grinding it down. And I've got one side of the frame welded on. I welded for the first time in my life, and it's a blast. I love it. And there comes a time, and here's why I told you the story. There comes in a time in your life when life just gets too big and you have to learn to ask for help. I love doing things on my own. I love sorting things out. I've figured out a lot of things. But there comes a time when you have to recognize it. I cannot do this. I just need help. And when we read the Psalms, we learn that God is our helper. We see that in a number of places. The word in Hebrews is very small. It's just Azar. I don't know if you've... Azar, it's formed the names like Ezra, Ebenezer, Azariah. All these names, they have this root word, Azar, which just means help. And we learn in Psalms that God is our helper. So here's what we're going to do for the rest of our time together this morning. I'm going to give you four steps to receive help from God. I don't know what your circumstance is, every one of you right now, what you're going through personally in your life, but regardless of what it is you're going through right now, I see four ways in Scripture, four steps that we can take to receive help from God. And the first step is this. Confess your weakness. When I was fixing that trailer, I had to recognize that, yeah, I'm in over my head. It's not going to get done if I just do it myself. I need to ask for help. And sometimes when we're dealing with things in life, we like to think that we can handle it all. When we come to God, we have to confess that we're weak and that we can't handle it all. One of the Psalms, Psalm 70, verse 5 says, I am poor and needy. Hasten to me, O God, for you are my help and my deliverer. O Lord, do not delay. There's a confession there. Come to me quickly, God, because I am poor and needy and I need your help. We don't like to talk about being poor and needy. We don't like to think about that. We like to think that we're strong and mighty and that we don't need other people to help us. But when it comes to us standing before God, the first thing we have to do is acknowledge our weakness, confess our weakness, that we're not strong and that we do need Him. If you flip to the next slide, I wanted to talk about the song Amazing Grace. That's actually a picture from the first time that song was ever written down in a hymn book. And it was, the English is so old that instead of the letter S, they still used Fs in old English, if you recognize that. But we all know this one, so I thought we'd sing the first verse.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found.
how sweet the sound that saved a, and no one likes to say this, a wretch like me. How would you describe your life? Oh, I'm a wretch. No one wants to say that, right? Well, first of all, it's older English and we don't understand what the word means anymore. But it's a difficult word to get over. And if you read a number of modern versions of that hymn in different hymn books, they've taken that word out because we don't like to admit that we need help. Sometimes they sing that saved a soul like me, that saved the rest like me, so it sounds almost the same. Or, and these are all good things, that saved and set me free. There's a trend not to sing that saved a wretch like me, but when we stand before God, the first thing we need to do is confess that we are weak, that we can't stand on our own, and ask Him for help. Another song we sing here, a song, we don't sing it that often, but it's one of my favorites from one of my favorite songwriters. Brian Dirksen wrote a song called Light the Fire Again. And the bridge of that song goes, I am here to buy gold refined in the fire. And you're like, yeah! Naked and poor, wretched and blind, I come. Oh, it's the harder part to sing. But it's just a quote from Revelation, and I wanted to read that. Revelation chapter 3, 17. Jesus, through John, is speaking to the church in Laodicea and says this, and this is pretty much a description, I think, of our culture today. And I know the temptation that I face is often to feel like this. God says, you say, I am rich. I have prospered. I don't need anything. Not realizing that you're wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. So I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire that you might be rich, white garments that you might clothe yourselves, the shame of your nakedness wouldn't be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. So be zealous and repent. The first step in receiving help from God is confessing that we don't have it all together and that we actually do need help. Has anyone seen that TV show, Till Debt Do Us Part? Okay, some of you are smiling. I can't help but like that lady. What's your name now? Can't even remember it. Anyways, the lady in the show, Till Debt Do Us Part, it's like a reality show, and if you haven't watched it before, they get people together that are having a hard time figuring out how to make their finances work, and oftentimes these people are making really good money. They just spend it all really quickly, and they're racking up debt. And the first part of every show is what she calls her reality check segment, basically. And what happens is she walks right into their house and says, I'm going to have a look around your house, okay? And they're okay. And she's, oh, I see you have a nice stainless steel fridge there. Let's look in it. And she opens it up. Oh, takeout containers, isn't it? It's all takeout. Oh, and she cuts them up and she criticizes the way they're living. And then she brings out a spreadsheet that shows their finances and they have to guess, how much money are you spending a month on entertainment? And they'll guess something like, oh, about $100. We go to the movies a couple times. And she's like, no, you're actually spending $800 a month in entertainment. And this lifestyle is... And she does this great big slap in the face to them to make them open their eyes and see. The first part of seeking help from God is kind of like that. And it doesn't always feel nice, but it's recognizing that we do have a problem. We do need help. And there's one person we can go to for it. The first way to seek help from God is to just acknowledge, as the psalmist said, that I am poor and needy. Hasten to me, O God. You're my help and my deliverer, O Lord, do not delay. But the second way to go to Him, and this is another area we get tripped up in, is to simply ask for help. It's one thing to recognize you're in need, but, and this may sound very basic, hear, O Lord, and be merciful to me. O Lord, be my helper. Hear, O Lord, and be merciful to me. O Lord, be my helper. Okay, there's just one thing I have to say. They forgot to do one thing in that study. They forgot to ask how many times men and women got lost. And if there's a ratio imbalance there, that's all I'm saying. But you understand. You understand what I'm saying? There's fault to be had on both sides. That's all. I'm just sharing the blame. That's all I'm saying.
You know that stereotype, though. You don't want to ask for help, and I've been there. You don't want to pull over the car and get out, try to bug someone for attention, and for all you know, the place you're going to can be right around the corner. Hear me, O Lord, and be merciful to me. We've got to get over that tendency to not want to ask for directions. Hear me, O Lord, and be merciful to me, O Lord. Be my helper. So I got thinking, what is it that makes us not want to ask God for help? What is it in our lives that prevents us from asking for help? And honestly, I think some of the reasons why you don't want to stop and ask for directions are some of the same reasons why you wouldn't want to stop and pause and ask God for help. Sometimes I wonder, I mean, and this was even mentioned in the newscast, if it's pride or if it's maybe shame that you don't have your life together that makes us pause and not ask God for help. We feel like we should be able to do it on our own. Or maybe it's shame. Maybe God has spoken to you a number of times in the past and you feel like, oh, I've disobeyed him so many times I can't go asking again. You can feel that shame. God still wants us to ask. Maybe it's unbelief. Maybe you really don't believe that God's interested in helping you. Maybe you come to church and you say the right things, but you just deep down think God is not available and is not interested in helping you. Maybe it's ignorance. You don't realize that God does want to help you. I wanted to read probably one of the most famous verses on asking for help. It's from Matthew chapter 7. And I really like the simple way that Jesus puts it. Matthew 7, starting at verse 7. Ask, and it'll be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. Because everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, it will be opened. When I had that trailer issue, and I said, Dave, what do you think I should do? It was solved in like 5 minutes. Oh, we'll sort it out, no problem. Ask and you shall receive. Knock and it'll be open. And then he goes on to put it this way about his father. Or which one of you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, will give him a serpent? The obvious answer is none of you. Well, if you then who are evil, Jesus really toned it down, eh? If you people who are evil know how to give good gifts to your kids, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to those who ask? He wants us to ask him for help. All through Scripture, people have asked him for help. And Jesus puts it plain, ask and it will be given to you. He's a good Father and he wants to give us good gifts. But we have to come to him recognizing that we don't have it all together, that we're weak. And secondly, we have to ask him for help. Well, the next thing we have to do, and sometimes we don't like doing this, is that we have to learn to wait. One of the Psalms says, our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. Our soul waits for the Lord because he is our help. There are times when even though we've prayed and asked God and come to him in weakness, we have to wait for the answer. And that can be difficult at times. My parents always made a big deal about Christmas morning. It was the biggest event of the year. And what they would do is we had the Christmas tree, and as people brought presents in throughout the month of December, they would go under the tree, but my parents would reserve all the really good gifts until that last morning. And what they would do is once we'd finally go to bed on Christmas Eve, they would, and many of us do this, load up the tree with presents. There was overflowing presents. They were all carefully arranged too, so it would look good in the Christmas picture. And there were presents all the way spreading out. And that was the special day of the year where the Christmas tree lights stayed on all night. They didn't get shut off when they went to bed and turned on in the morning. They stayed on all night. And like any kid before Christmas, I woke up many times during the night. And I would get out of my bed. My parents would sleep in the upstairs bedroom. I slept in a main floor bedroom. My sister slept upstairs as well. So I get up in the night, and when I wouldn't hear any more noise, I would go out and I would go through the kitchen and see around the corner to the Christmas tree. You would see this multicolored glow, and you would see stacks of presents flowing out.
And I remember I would just kind of lean back and lay on the living room floor with my hand in my face and just stare at it. Stare. And we had rules about what time we were allowed to wake the parents up at. I think it was 6:30 and it was still torture. And we just wait, and then I'd hear my sister's little feet on the steps, and we both look. And we'd sneak, and they were very carefully arranged, so we had to be careful when we'd shake presents to make sure they got back exactly the same way. And we'd wait, and we'd wait, and we'd wait. Time has never moved slower than the time between 5:30 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. when you're wanting to open those presents, and you're just staring at them. But you learn to wait. Good things come to those who wait is what they say, right? There are times when God makes us wait and we don't like it because we like to have everything fast. I can heat my coffee up in 55 seconds in my microwave. We like to have everything fast, but there are times God makes us wait. All different reasons for that. Sometimes I think he wants to build our character. Sometimes there are other plans in motion. There's all sorts of different things. I could give you lots of examples. But the point is, there are times when we have to wait. But just like there were good things for me when I would wait at Christmas time, God promises his children good things. This is a famous passage. I want you to hear it again from Isaiah 40, starting at verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, that my way is hidden from God? My way is disregarded by my God. He's saying, church, why do you say that God's not interested in helping me? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God. He is the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not grow faint or weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even young people will faint and be weary, and young men will fall exhausted. But, and here's when most of us can probably join in by memory, they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Israel as a nation waited 70 years in captivity for God's promise to come through, but it came through at the right time. I hope none of us have to wait 70 years. But there are times when God makes us wait. It doesn't mean that he doesn't want to help us. It means there's something else in store. Acknowledge your weakness, ask for help, learn to wait, and then this is probably one of the most important things. While you're waiting, remember how God has helped you in the past. Remember the help. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, I'm just going to give you the condensed version of this story. It's a fantastic story. Be good to preach on someday. Israel went through this great victory. This Ark of the Covenant that symbolized the presence of God was taken back from enemy hands and it was back in their own land. But then, in the midst of their celebration and in their God-fearing joy, time started to pass. And year passed after year after year after year, and about 20 years after that great victory, people had become lazy. They had forgotten about God. They had started to turn their backs on him. They've started to serve the gods of the other people who lived in the land. They wandered away from God. Well, Samuel the prophet, 20 years after this, stepped up and said, Israel, listen to me. You've fallen away from God. You need to repent, and God will take you back. And there was something spirited. I'm summarizing this, obviously. But there was something spirit-anointed in his words, because sometimes you think if you heard that, you would just be likable to say, go home and take off, right? Mm-hmm. But something was spirit-anointed in those words, and Samuel the prophet's words cut to the heart of the people, and Israel repented as a group from all different tribes. They came together to say, God, we're sorry. We have followed other gods. We've forgotten what you've done for us. We're sorry. We've come to you now. We're returning to you in confession. And Samuel said, okay, good. Let's do this. Let's all meet together at this one place. We're going to offer sacrifices to God, renew the covenant with God, and start fresh. And it's what many of us do in our lives that a number of times. You recognize that maybe you fall a little further away from God than you ever intended to, and you make that fresh commitment to Him. This is what Israel was doing. So they all meet together. Samuel sacrifices the animals, puts them up on the altar. As he was doing that, the Philistines caught wind of it. They were the enemies from the next land over. And the Philistines thought, this is the perfect opportunity. All of Israel's up there at a big, basic, what we would call a church service. They're not set up militarily. If we strike while they're worshiping, we can take them. We can be rid of them. We can utterly decimate Israel at this time. So the Philistines started coming to attack in secret. And so you can just imagine Samuel, everyone repenting and praying, the prophet Samuel offering sacrifices to God. Well, the Philistine army was sneaking up on them, and they were helpless. So what happens? Samuel 7, 1 Samuel 7. As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, right as it was happening, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were routed before Israel. In the midst of their worst nightmare, a sneak attack from the Philistines, God spoke. God thundered, and the Philistines scattered. And so Samuel says, this is worth remembering. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen, in verse 12. And he called its name Ebenezer, stone of help. For he said, until now the Lord has helped us. What Samuel did is he said, I don't want you in 20 years to forget that God has done this amazing thing in your life, because we saw what happened the last 20 years. God does something amazing, you serve Him, and then you drift away from Him and you go your own way. I'm going to put this great big stone, set it up here. We're going to call it Ebenezer, which means the stone of help. And every time you see this stone, every time you pass through this road and see this big rock here, I want you to remember that God has helped you in your past, and He's not going to forget about you in your future. I think there's a powerful lesson for us there, because just like Israel, we like to wander away from God. We get lazy, we get distracted, we just lose that passion that we once had. It's so easy to slip into that mode where church going just becomes routine, and we've lost the really heart of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. And one of the ways that we can recapture that is to remember where God has helped us in the past. That's why we started the service this morning with, O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. The psalmist said, I was pushed hard, so hard that I was falling, but the Lord helped me. That's why this summer, almost every Sunday we've gotten together, I've asked you for a testimony of how God has worked in your life. Because just like Samuel's stone that he called Ebenezer, when we tell stories about how God has been active in our lives, it builds up our faith, and it reminds us, as we're waiting for help to come, that He is our helper, and He will help us.